Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. Bhopal, an Indian bishop, helps us remember. When Pope Benedict invites both Jewish and Muslim artists to be custodians of beauty. The role of Vatican Radio in Lithuania before the fall of the communist regime. A story told by the Cardinal Archbishop of Vilnius. And marking the second Sunday in Advent on a musical note. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to begin today by marking a special anniversary. If you happen to be old enough, you may remember the name, Bhopal. Yes, that Indian city where the worst industrial disaster in history killed thousands, leaving many more seriously injured. Emma McCarthy speaks to the Bishop of Bhopal, Leo Cornelio, about the legacy of this disaster 25 years on.
The people are reliving that experience of 25 years ago. Some have witnessed it. Those who are no more in this world, they are gone, thousands of them. But there are others who are affected, and their children are also somehow affected, and the consequence is still seen. And it is said that the place has still that toxic content in the place. They have not removed it fully. And the compensation for the people who have been suffering, that is also not somehow forthcoming. Lot of agitation, the poor or those who are not able to raise their voice, they can't somehow make things felt or heard by the people who should be hearing. Whom to blame, where really the blame lies, we don't know.
It really does cry about injustice. You know, this very wealthy American company exploiting the poor of this area of Bhopal. And if I'm not mistaken, very recently the Indian government had an inquiry into the Bhopal disaster, came to a conclusion that there was no longer any pollution in the area. But the scientists are saying this is not true. The area is still polluted. Yes. What is your information?
That area is cordoned off. That is completely blocked area. I have been there also in that area. And there is nobody who stays inside. But definitely the air passes through and pollution would definitely be there. Because there are toxic contents still. It is not fully removed and not fully cleansed. So they cannot say there is no more pollution. It may not be that visible, but then definitely there is in the surroundings the pollution still, I believe.
What is the church doing in Bhopal to try and, first of all, ease the suffering of those who have been physically affected by the Bhopal disaster? And secondly, to try and improve conditions for the poor and those affected by the Bhopal disaster?
Yeah. See, to relieve this kind of, you know, painful situation and help them, the church has been doing a lot already from the time the disaster took place. Today we have three schools or residential places for children, particularly mentally challenged, physically challenged. We are trying to train them and somehow to face the world. And many of these children are actually children of those people who are affected because the consequence is seen in their children. Then we have a lot of social work going on, different congregations as well as the church personnel who are getting involved with the people, poor and needy. Particularly in their education, the health care. We have a couple of hospitals. There are two hospitals are there in Bhopal run by the church. Then there is a women's development for the women, employment, self-employment facilities provided, some Christian organizations. So that way the church is very much involved. And we are also trying our best to bring the cause of the poor to the government. And the government as such with us, you know, they are ready to dialogue and they are open. But then the problem really is that well, it has become an international issue, not only of the state issue. So there is a lot of tug of war and I think court cases and so on. How far the justice would be done for the poor people because they don't have much of a voice. In the process, there are also other people who benefit from any tragedy, any disaster. There are some who are powerful people who benefit much more. They don't see from the point of view of the cry of the poor. So they themselves are somehow looking for their benefit, their good.
And my thanks there go to the Bishop of Bhopal, Leo Cornelio, and to Emma McCarthy for bringing us this interview to mark 25 years since the Bhopal gas leak devastation. And now we go from devastation to beauty. As we know, Benedict XVI met with artists in that cenacle of art and artists, the Sistine Chapel, on the 21st of November, an event which took place in the footsteps of that first historic meeting of artists with Paul VI back in May 1964, and one during which the Pope asked the over 200 artists present in the Sistine to renew that long-estranged relationship between the Church and the world of art. A request to a renewed friendship, dialogue and collaboration between the worlds of faith and art, which his predecessor to the See of Peter, John Paul II, had also asked for in a letter to artists 10 years ago. Among the artists from different artistic disciplines, cultures and traditions invited to the Vatican in this most recent gathering were two architects, one Muslim-born, the other Jewish-born.
This is not about being a Catholic. I'm Jewish, but it's about the fact that the borders that used to divide the world are breaking down and the world needs to understand things together and not through a kind of separation of old.
You were listening there to Daniel Libeskind, architect, artist and set designer of Polish-Jewish descent.
I'm born as a Muslim and I went to a Catholic school in Baghdad, and I think it kind of taught us all that all religions can coexist and also that there's generosity and spirit to accept difference. So I think to invite all these people here to share their views eventually with the Church, I think it could be a very liberating idea.
And that was Zaha Hadid, British Iraqi architect. Both artists invited by the Holy Father to the Sistine Chapel. Let's listen to an extract from his speech to them, read for us by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Too often, the beauty that is thrust upon us is illusory and deceitful, superficial and blinding, leaving the onlooker dazed instead of bringing him out of himself and opening him up to horizons of true freedom. As it draws him aloft, it imprisons him within himself and further enslaves him, depriving him of hope and joy. It's a seductive but hypocritical beauty that rekindles desire, the will to power, to possess, and to dominate others. It's a beauty which soon turns into its opposite, taking on the guise of indecency, transgression, or gratuitous provocation.
And now we've listened to the Holy Father's words, I'd like to join my German colleague, Gudrun Seiler, who asked both Zaha Hadid and Daniel Libeskind how they reacted to Pope Benedict's request when he urged them to use their talents to be custodians of beauty in our contemporary world.
The Holy Father did a deep reflection on beauty and its absence in the art of today. What do you think about it?
The discourse was about the importance of art and creativity in a world which is full of ugliness and brutality. And I think that's a message that goes across all aesthetic beliefs and all ideas about beauty and ugliness. It's about the human condition today. So I think it was a very profound discourse. It was a profound a spiritual aspect that art isn't just a commercial endeavor to decorate the world, but it is a key to really expressing the meaning of life. The very fact that the meeting was held at the Sistine Chapel, which itself is a proof that art is alive and that art speaks to the deepest aspects of the human soul. It wasn't disappointing because knowing that this poet is an intellectual, the discourse was on a very high intellectual level.
Zaha Hadid was a little bit more optimistic. Yes, she told Gudrun that while she does agree there might be absence of beauty, that's definitely not the rule.
You know, maybe it's some art, but I think generally there's some really fantastic works. And maybe these kind of meetings makes it more accessible to him as well and make him more accessible to us.
Have you been surprised to be invited?
I thought it was kind of a very generous thing to invite all of us here. And, you know, the space is glorious and it's a nice day and I was in Rome. And I think these kind of connections, one should not be blasé about them because I think they're very important historically to kind of have these connections between different worlds.
If you were asked to build a church for the Vatican?
I don't imagine these things, but yeah, I mean, I think it could be very nice to work on a space within the Vatican.
My thanks there go to Zaha Hadid, British Iraqi architect, and to Daniel Libeskind, US architect of Polish Jewish descent, and naturally to my colleague from our German desk, Gudrun Seiler. Curiously, I read that one of the projects Zaha Hadid has worked on recently was for the Guggenheim Hermitage in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, a nation I'll be taking you with me to in a moment. Lithuania, then once deleted off the map and currently celebrating its millennium. Join me as we go on a journey back in time to not so distant, bleak days for the church there. A tale of how the people of this overwhelmingly Catholic nation kept the faith alive through its different historical phases, until the collapse of the Soviet regime 20 years ago. The person to tell the story is no other than the Cardinal Archbishop of Vilnius, Audris Bačkis.
Lithuania has a checkered history, a painful history. It had a communist regime, a Soviet occupation for over 50 years, I think. It was interspersed with a Nazi occupation. During this period, the Lithuanians clung on to their faith. Is that a correct statement in your view? What are we talking about when we're talking about suffering and persecution of Catholics?
Certainly, after the Soviet occupation, I mean the first one, in 1940, there was a lot of persecution against the church and the intellectuals. There was in June 1940, the deportation to Siberia, about 40,000 people, but they were chosen, the elite, 100 more priests, let's say the mayor of the village, the intellectual, things like that. So it was a very strong blow to the country. A lot of suffering, but people who have grown in a Catholic surrounding in the faith and were able, even in Siberia, even elsewhere, to keep the faith. It's wonderful now today. I saw some religious congregations, some girls were born in Siberia. So it means that the parents were able in this condition where there were no priest, no church, nothing to keep alive the faith. So then it was a persecution. After there was the Nazi occupation for 4 years, and the most difficult thing at that time, sometimes some people had a sense of guilt, it was the persecution of the Jews. About 200,000 Jews were deported from Lithuania. Of course, it was done by the Nazis, but, well, many Lithuanians defend and took risk in defense, some other, as usual, or were passive or collaborate. But then, after the second occupation of 1944, the government wanted to take control of the church, beginning from the head. So it was directly against the bishops. We refused to collaborate. closing down the seminary, not closing down, putting a so-called numerus clausus, a maximum up to 25 students. There were 400 seminaries before the war. The blow against the bishop is very simple. The Archbishop of Vilnius, Reinis, my predecessor, died in the prison of Vladimir in 1953. He was arrested in 1948, and he died. Another bishop, Borisevich on Telšiai, in the north of the country, lately executed in Vilnius itself. Some others were sent to the jail, so that in 1967 there was only one bishop left in all Lithuania for six dioceses. Some fled abroad, that's true, Archbishop of Kaunas and two auxiliary bishops, but those who remained in the country were really in very difficult situation. So the seminary was also one of the targets. You cannot enter the seminary if you have made higher studies and things like that. They were trying to keep the lowest level.
And what happened on a daily basis there?
To make catechesis was forbidden. I mean, if you meet with three young people, it was a crime. It could be. And so the priests, little by little, were pushed to a ministry only of sacraments. They only distribute the sacraments, don't get out, don't have contact with the people, avoid all that. And the church survived, I would say, thanks to some very courageous priests, and mostly some very courageous lay people. I think it's the families, mostly the mothers, were able to transmit what they believe in to their children, things like that. So it was a time of great witness of faith up to the martyrs, the persecution. But then our occupation in Lithuania lasted 50 years. It was not the Nazi occupation in France of 5 years. And you can understand in 50 years, with all the discrimination against the churchgoers, let's say, if we are a member of the party, you go to the church for marriage or you baptize your children, you lose your job. So many people were obliged to look for a compromise to survive, for the future of the children mostly.
Do priests have to hide their identity?
No, they have not to hide their identity, but they have a permit. And they were the best priests were very active, were moved from one parish to another for every 3 months by the ministry. And they're giving a permit of work, let's say, to the priest. And if you were not acting according to the will of the Ministry for Religious Affairs, or they take away from you this permit, and you cannot work so as a priest. You are obliged to stay in the place where you are assigned. Some of them were sent to make all kind of civil work. The actual bishop of Panevėžys, one of the rural dioceses of the country, rural not so more now, the town has 200,000 people, waited 13 years to enter the seminary, renewing the youngies. Finally he entered, but he had difficulties afterwards, also obliged to work as a civil clerk for some time. And he was one of the founders of the Committee for the Defense of the Rights of the Christians, not only Catholic. So I would say it was a time where the church was very limited. We have a very heroic witness of some lay people, some priests. And the most important thing to help the people was, I would say, the Vatican Radio was transmitted to Lithuanian and passing the news even about what was happening in the country. Because in Lithuania, like under the communist regime, there was a complete control of the school and a complete control of the mass media. So when there was some violation of human rights, let's say, against children were seen by the teacher going to school and they were scolded and sent away from the school, things like that, there was a chronicle of events of the Lithuanian church was published since, I think, 1972 up to the independence and was relating these facts. And the Vatican Radio was transmitted back to the country. Of course, I remember I was working in Rome. We were trying to avoid to make too personal, not to quote names against the one or the other, but it make a big support.
It wasn't forbidden to listen to Vatican Radio?
Yes, it was forbidden. They were trying to hiding. But forbidden, you know, at the beginning was very real persecution. But later on, in the last years, let's say, of communist regime, 10, 15 years before the freedom, already people were more free to do what they want. One bishop who came here told me, you go in a hospital and at the hour of the Vatican radio, you hear all the transistor, everybody listening to the Vatican radio publicly. Many things depend from the local Communist Party, the local Secretary General. If it was a harsh man fighting against the church, it was almost impossible to do anything. Some others were, well, making compromise and knowing the mood of the people. But to give you an example, Christmas was a working day. It was impossible to feast priests. They put all these limits to impede people to celebrate the feast, not only to go to the church, but even to take away this atmosphere of sacred feast, of rest. Well, I mean the most thing, because all the Catholic instruction was impossible. The religious instruction, not in the school, but also in the church, was very difficult.
So they used a very subtle technique, really. It wasn't a crackdown as such, but it was...
At the beginning, yes. The era of Stalin, it was very strong. But later on, they used more psychological means. Let's say even a boy is entering a seminary. They told him, look, if you want to become a priest, you have to collaborate with us. Not persecuting, but also once a month we shall meet in a cafe, in a restaurant. You will tell me something about this professor, about that man, and things like that. But unfortunately, the young people began used to serve two masters, who says in the gospel, to serve the state and to serve the church, if they want to survive, to have a parish, to be able to work. So it was a subtitle, as you say. But at the beginning, the time of Stalin, well, let's remember in 1948, we have over 200,000 people deported to Siberia. It was the time they introduced the kolkhoz, collective farms, so destroyed all the small property. Of course, you know, the peasants did not want the farmers to leave their place. So they were, all family were deported. I know the sister of my mother, my aunt, was deported with her husband and a boy of 18 years old. And they spent 15 years. They survived, thanks to God.
My thanks there go to the Cardinal Archbishop of Vilnius, Audrys Bačkis. Finally, let's end on Advent Notes with music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Repent and be baptized. The Lord is at hand. With these words, John the Baptist burst onto the scene on the banks of the River Jordan, dressed in camel hair with a leather belt round his waist. He must have cut quite a remarkable figure. On the second Sunday of Advent, our liturgy focuses on this powerful preacher, the one who came to prepare the way for the coming of the Lord, to make his paths straight. In proclaiming his message, of course, John was continuing in the line of the Old Testament prophet, particularly Isaiah. Long before John was born, Isaiah had spoken of a voice crying in the wilderness, "Prepare a way for the Lord, make his path straight. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill made low, the crooked straight, and the rough places plain."
Every valley shall be exalted,
That music comes near the beginning of Handel's Messiah. Starting with the prophecies of Isaiah, Handel takes us through the Christmas story and on through the Passion, the Resurrection, and the Glorification of Christ. No wonder there are so many performances of Handel's Messiah at this time of year. If you get a chance to listen to one, it's a good way of preparing for Christmas and reflecting on the deeper meaning of the Incarnation. Some of the hymns we sing during Advent take the preaching of John the Baptist as a starting point. On Jordan's bank, the Baptist's cry announces that the Lord is nigh. Come then and hearken, for he brings glad tidings from the King of Kings. As we prepare for the Lord's coming, we do well to make a straight path for him in our own hearts by repenting of our sins and turning back to him. That, after all, was John the Baptist's message. The next verse of the hymn takes up this theme. Even though we sing it only once a year, it's a popular hymn and one that people find easy to remember. That's partly because the same tune is used again on Palm Sunday to the words, ride on in majesty. It's an old German tune adapted for these two very different English texts during the Victorian period. Another popular hymn from the same period begins, like this one, with a reference to John the Baptist. The thrilling voice which seems to say, Christ is nigh. Advent is a beautiful season, and a surprisingly short one, just over 3 weeks altogether. There's plenty of fine Advent music to listen to in that short time. It's a real shame that so often, instead of focusing on Advent, we find ourselves singing Christmas carols all through December. Do try and avoid doing that if you can. It's like opening the presents early.
Heartfelt thanks there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian, who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.